All right, we're now embarking on a whole new sort of topic, although a little bit of this has been prefigured in the discussion of class formation, especially the last couple of discussions in various ways. The section of the course on politics, the state, and then on ideology, these really all sort of fit together. In the classical framework, these are all part of the discussion of superstructure, but they're also both centrally involved with the problem of transformation. Because after all, the question of transformation is, to a significant extent, transforming the conditions of reproduction of the existing system. Remember when I briefly went through the kind of elements of a theory of transformation, I began with the theory of reproduction, saying that if we want to transform a system of inequality, of repression, of repressive and oppressive relations, the first thing we have to figure out is how is this system reproduced? It doesn't just continue by inertia. It's actively reproduced through a set of mechanisms. If those were fully effective and totalizing, then there would really be no opening for transformation, or at least no opening for transformation that has the character of purposive transformation. That is, transformation that's the result of human purposes being directed at transforming the world in which we live. Social change could still happen. Social change happens all the time as a byproduct of just the mundane activities of people. We'd have social change, but we wouldn't have social transformation. So first we study reproduction. Then we look at the contradictions of reproduction. Where are the gaps, the openings, which create the possibility for agency, the possibility for strategy? The possibility of strategy comes from the fact that reproduction is incomplete, not totalizing, not a closed cage. But because the system has social change, not just transformation, it has all these cumulative, unintended consequences that build up and produce change, whatever we understand about reproduction and contradictions, that changes over time. And so our strategies have to attend to not merely what a static configuration of reproduction and its limits are, but how those change over time. And that was the third element of a theory of transformation, was this notion of a theory of the trajectories of unintended social change. That was the element that the theory of history was meant to solve. That's one of the things that Marx himself thought was a great, one of his most important contributions, was understanding the laws of motion of capitalism. That expression, that's a pretty strong set of terms, laws of motion. That implies not merely you figured out how it works, but you figured out how it changes over time. You've got a whole theory of trajectory into the future, and if you really had that, if you really could create such a theory, then you'd be in an incredible position with respect to answering the question, what is to be done? Because you'd say, okay, look, here's the problem we face. There's these powerful institutions of reproduction. They have contradictions, and we've got a pretty good idea how this combination of reproduction and contradiction is going to move over time. How can we organize our strategies now to take advantage, both in the present and in the future, which we know is likely to come, take advantage of these contradictions to open up spaces for transformation? That's what such a theory of history would give us. But we don't have them. And I don't think we even really have a sketch of it in a plausible way. We just can't say very much that's useful about what the character of the configuration of reproduction and contradiction will be 50 years from now. Or even what the tendencies are. We can speculate about it. People can say all sorts of things. They can extrapolate from the present. But really, what we have is good account of the mechanisms that reproduce the world as it is. We have a good understanding of lots of gaps and limits and contradictions in that process. And then we just have to kind of play it by ear as those evolve and change over time, taking advantage of opportunities when they occur, perhaps knowing that there will be crises in the futures of some sort which will create openings, and we should be armed, you know, in the metaphorical sense, with ideas about what to do when times are ripe. But we can't really do much better than that. Now, a big part of that whole story centers around the state and ideology, because those are absolutely central to the process, both of the reproduction of the system and its gaps. So I think it's important, and this is one of the things we'll be playing with, it's important not to see the contradictions and gaps and limits in the system of in which we live as entirely generated by the base, by the economic system. It's easy to understand why there are all sorts of contradictions within capitalism. There are also contradictions internal to the state and internal to ideology. Now, one view, which I will not be advancing, but it is a view in the Marxian world about these things, is that while there are contradictions in the economy, class contradictions rooted in exploitation and domination, the system of reproduction is itself internally non-contradictory. That is, you have a well-oiled, coherent state which functions to hold the contradictions of the base in place. And you have a well-oiled hegemonic ideology with all the bits and pieces nicely orchestrated to back up the state and the economy through the formation of subjectivities. But they don't contain internal contradictions. Or if they are shadows of contradictions, they're all merely displacements of the contradictions in this class structure and the economy. But they're nothing that could be properly called a political contradiction or an ideological contradiction. Now, I'm going to argue that it's contradictions all the way down. Nothing fits together in perfect ways. This is not an organic system where all the parts have nice functional roles which they fulfill in a homeostatic and comfortable way. I'm going to then argue for a more unsettling theoretical position. It's one that has less closure. It's not as neat. But it's a view of the whole system as being both functional and contradictory. It's what I'm going to call contingent contradictory functionality as the basic way to think about the state and ideology. And we'll get to that. Actually, it should be contingent, contested, contradictory. I left in my notes, I left off one word. It's contingent, contested, contradictory functionality. A nice little, you got three C's. Contingent, contested, contradictory. It's too bad the word functionality begins with F.
I just don't have the microphone on. Is it recording?
I think it is.
Okay.
I lost my microphone.
I didn't notice. I just definitely, oh no.
Yeah, I lost my cute little microphone. Disappeared between one class. Right. Okay. So that's the location of this block of the class. Now our tasks are going to be many-fold here. I'm partially going to be just explaining the ideas around the state and politics, getting clear definitions of the core concepts. Many of these definitions and ideas will be relevant for your work outside of the domains of our particular concerns here. So I'm going to give you a vocabulary for talking about politics and ideology and certain closely connected themes like culture. I'm going to give you a vocabulary for talking about it that sort of sorts out the differences and the uses of this that I think are of good, coherent use, even if you're studying things that are not about these grand themes of transforming the world into a better place. You'll be getting a vocabulary. This lecture in particular is a kind of dictionary lecture, but I hope engaging dictionary as opposed to a tedious dictionary. We'll be doing that. We'll be reviewing some of the central theoretical debates around these ideas, the ones which I think are the most productive debates. So we'll be touching lightly, but nevertheless, I hope, not superficially, on some of the central issues around the state and ideology. in the discussion of ideology, we're also going to be doing something which I think is not so typical in Marxian discussions. We're going to talk about the, if you will, the psychological infrastructure, the psychological foundations of ideology. In a sense, a kind of social psychology of ideology. Mostly cognitive psychology, which I think for theories of ideology is the most relevant aspect, because ideology is a belief-laden aspect of subjectivity. Thus, it does have this strongly cognitive character. And I think some elementary elements of cognitive psychology help us to understand how ideology works. That will be one of the, I think that might even be the last lecture. It's under the rubric, the micro foundations of ideology at the end of the ideology section. So, I think we're now in a part of the course where I really enjoy each of these lectures. They all have really interesting ideas as well as, I hope, important ones. All right, and there were some hands I thought that were coming up at some point. All right, well, the first block here, the under introduction, I think pretty much I put down review. I almost feel it's possible to largely skip this. So let me just spend no more than 5 minutes on this brief review about base and superstructure, since we have talked about this quite a bit in an earlier part of the course. So first, what is a superstructure? What's the whole point of this concept, base and superstructure? This is not a fashionable way to talk about these things any longer. Even among people who are very seriously working inside of the Marxist tradition, base superstructure ways of talking about the state and politics has a very anachronistic, old-fashioned ring to it. Almost nobody invokes these metaphors. And when they get invoked, you can almost be sure that it's going to be orthodox, rigid, and not very nuanced. So I don't really deploy this language in the things I write about the state and ideology, except in order to indicate how my ideas relate to these older ideas. I don't really use the base superstructure metaphor very much. Still, I want to just clarify it because it is part of the backdrop for Marxian discussions. So first, what is a superstructure? The simplest way to think about this is the following. Without superstructures, bases would collapse. Bases need superstructures. Without superstructures, bases would collapse. That's why I think locating the base superstructure problem within the notion of a theory of social reproduction is the way to think about it. Cohen uses this nice metaphor of a four struts held up by a roof, right? So you have these four vertical struts, and then you put a roof on top of them, you know, with little slots in the corners so the struts fit into it. And you can say, without the roof, the struts would fall over. And if you put the roof on top in order to keep the struts vertical, you could say the function of the roof is to keep the struts in place. Why is there a roof? Because without it, the struts would fall down. Now, when you think of it that way, one can hardly say that the superstructure is unimportant. Without the superstructure, there would be no base. It would collapse. The base superstructure metaphor, this way of thinking about the relationship of the state and ideology to economic structures, that way of thinking about it gives huge importance to the base, to the superstructure. It does not treat them as epiphenomenal, as irrelevant, as secondary importance. They're of absolutely fundamental importance. Without them, the system would collapse. You can hardly assign more importance to the state or to ideology than to say without them, capitalism would disintegrate. So that's the whatever else you think about the base superstructure, it's a little mechanical, it's too functionalist, it implies too strong a notion of system. Societies just aren't like that. They're not organisms. It's just not the right metaphor. Nevertheless, this basic key idea that capitalism is the kind of economic system which cannot reproduce itself without the presence of strong institutions to maintain it. And the institutions that are focused on above all are ideological institutions and political institutions, the state. That's an insight which I think is valid and which we need to keep. All of this means that superstructures really are bound up with this peculiar kind of explanation called functional explanation, which we spent, you know, a reasonable amount of time on, so I'm not going to review that in any detail at all here. The basic intuition of a functional explanation is that there are circumstances in which the consequence of something helps to explain that thing's existence. The consequence of something is explanatory of the thing itself. The consequence of X helps explain X. So we ask, why do birds have hollow wings? So we're trying to explain the hollowness of the bones in the wings of birds. And we ask, why do they have it? How do we explain it? And we say, because this enables the birds to fly. That is the explanation for why the bones are hollow. And on the face of it, that's a pretty bizarre claim, because it's a consequence, it's an effect of hollow bones that the wings are light enough to give the birds the ability to fly. And we're using that consequence as an explanation for the property. The consequence of a property explains the property. Well, we know why that works in biology, because of natural selection. It's because it's not a static explanation. It occurs over time, and we have a way to explain the evolution of those properties which do enable various kinds of fitness. Ultimately, because of reproductive fitness, you know, that's the genius of Darwin, is to figure out that it's all about sex. It's not about flight. It's not about flight at all. It's really just about how flight enables the genes of a bird to have a higher probability of being passed on. You know, it's a fantastically interesting idea and very robust. You know, I think it's one of these scientific discoveries about which there is no doubt that it's basically correct, even if there's other mechanisms in evolution besides just natural selection. We discussed the Trowbridge and Ireland case, which I also think is a cool one. You know, the fishing boats and fear. Functional explanations, I think, are absolutely and pervasively important in biology. And there's little controversy, except in some esoteric corners of philosophy and science, about the legitimacy of functional explanations in biology. I also think that they have a place in sociology and social science. And there is controversy about that. Not everybody thinks that functional explanations are a legitimate type of explanation in sociology. Virtually everybody agrees that functional explanations are not a legitimate explanation in physics and astronomy. That is, we observe that the sun heats the earth and makes life on earth possible. So a consequence of the sun being 93 million miles away from the earth and our orbit being the way it is and the planet rotating on its axis the way it does, a consequence of all of that is that life on earth is possible and thrives. But we all reject the explanation for why the sun is 93 million miles away and why we rotate on our axis and why our orbit is the way it is. We don't say the reason why we have these celestial configurations is so that there can be life on Earth. Right? So we don't have a functional explanation of the sun. We can have a functional description. It is indeed the case that the sun produces beneficial effects for the life on Earth, but that doesn't explain anything about the sun. In medieval science, it did. That was why the sun is where it is, why the sun has the properties it does. There was a kind of non-natural selection, if you will, argument lurking behind. It was intelligent design. God planned it that way. So there was an intentional explanation behind the functional explanation in physics, in astronomy, in the medieval period. All of that's been completely rejected. So nobody, I think, and no scientist at any rate, would opt for a functional explanation for physical phenomena. All biologists accept functional explanations in biology. And in social science, it's a contested terrain. Some do, some don't. Mostly, I think, one should take a kind of eclectic position on this. I don't see a principal objection here. There are circumstances in which functional explanations are at least part of the explanation. And there are things in certain specialized cases that are quite close to natural selection. The competitive pressures of the market on the form and strategies of capitalist firm have a rather Darwinian character to it, so that those firms which happen to, through whatever process, develop strategies which are good for the bottom line are firms that are likely to survive and reproduce themselves over time. It's not that they have children, so it's not exactly genetic, but it's a close approximation. They reproduce themselves over time more effectively. So the population of firms over time will be those that have profit-maximizing strategies. And if there's some big shock to the system, equivalent of an asteroid hitting the Earth, which disrupts the functionality of firms so that firms that had functional structures suddenly become dysfunctional, those firms which are able to modify or were lucky enough to have the right properties at that moment will be the ones that will be more likely to survive, and so you'll have a change in the ecology of firm strategies over time. So that's basically a functional explanation, it seems to me. And even Jan Elster, who's pretty hostile to functionalism in social science, acknowledges that market-type conditions generate something that's reasonably called functional explanations. Elster's main objection to functional explanations is that they are often just intellectually sloppy. They involve just making up stories. And that they really disguise what are properly described as intentional explanations. So this is one of these philosophy of science points. It's a kind of deeper methodological point in sociology that's worth paying attention to and kind of having in your intellectual armory. And that's the distinction between a functional explanation and an intentional explanation. I've mentioned this before, but I think it's worth just repeating it one more time. And the way to think about it is the following. In an intentional explanation, something is explained by the anticipated consequences. So we ask, why did the state engage in this deregulatory policy? And the answer is, because of the expectation that it would produce benevolent effects for the rate of accumulation. So we explain the policy not by its actual effects, but by its intended effects. Now, note, in the case of the hollow bones of the bird, we're not explaining the property of the bird by the intended effects of the wings, but it's by its actual effects. It actually does help birds to fly, and that's why it is the way it is. It's its actual effects that explain the property. In an intentional explanation, it is always the anticipated effects, which means anticipated by an agent, by a thinking being, by a planner, by a chooser. That's an intentional explanation. Intentional explanations are the bread and butter of everyday life. We all constantly invoke intentional explanations to explain why we and our friends and Scott Walker do things. As you always, what you ascribe to people are that they had reasons. An intentional explanation is another way of talking about it, is people have reasons for doing things. And the reasons have something to do with the consequences of the actions. It could have to do with the meanings of the actions. Sometimes you do things not because of your expected effects, but just by the intrinsic qualities of the action. That's another reason for doing something. This is a discussion, it gets lots of nuances when you play it out. We don't need to go through them all. The key point is, an intentional explanation invokes the choices of actors, the decisions made why to act the way they do, in which their purposes are the core to explaining why they did what they did. Whereas a functional explanation invokes the actual consequences of what happens as part of the explanation, not the intended consequences. And what Elster says is that mostly what people, when they make functional explanations, really what's behind them are intentional explanations. That's why the policies are the way they are, is because people thought it would be good for capitalism. Sometimes what they think will be good for capitalism turns out to be good for capitalism. Sometimes what they think will be good for capitalism turns out to be bad for capitalism. But the explanation of the policy is always what they think, not what the actual policies are. Now, the reason why I still think it's appropriate to include a functional aspect or dimension to our explanations is if we want to answer the question, why do certain policies tend to stick and stay robust and be adopted and copied elsewhere, it's at least in part because of assessments of the actual effects of those policies. That over time, because it's an iterated process, and because human beings have learning capacity, and our institutions can be designed to enhance or impede that learning capacity, disastrous policies that are totally destructive of the conditions for accumulation will tend to be abandoned. And policies which are very favorable to the stability of capitalism will tend to be adopted. And the explanation for that, for why there are those tendencies, invokes the actual effects of policies, plus our capacity to make changes in light of those effects. So it's a combination of intentional and functional explanation that come into play in explaining why, by and large, states reproduce class relations, as opposed to sometimes they do and sometimes they don't, depending upon how smart the actors are. Yeah?
How do causal explanations fit into social science? Because I feel like it was philosophy and these people who talk about social facts as being, as social structures being a set of relationships, a set of causal relationships between social facts.
So, the way I think Elster has a nice way of describing this. Elster distinguishes three kinds of explanations: causal, intentional, and functional. These are three types of explanations. Causal explanations are explanations of the form. You have a set of conditions which generate a set of consequences. And the word generate implies that there's some mechanism involved. There's some mechanism by which, when those conditions are present, there is an effect-generating process, right? Unpacking that mechanism is what you do when you do a causal analysis. Intentional explanations, then, can be thought of as a subtype of causal explanation. It's when you unpack the process by which these conditions generate these effects, it turns out that the purposes of actors are central. That the purposes of actors explain why those effects were generated. The purposes of actors. You explain their action by their purposes, but the effects of their action are not explained by their purposes. So the prisoner's dilemma is an example where the outcome is nobody's purpose. The aggregated consequence of each person engaging in their own strategies produces an outcome, which is the result of the aggregation of the consequences of each person's act. But that aggregation is no one's purpose. You know, that's the beauty of the prisoner's dilemma as an example. You get an outcome that is entirely the result of the purposes of actions without the outcome being a purpose. That's why they call it a paradox, right? It's a really nice fact. So you cannot say that the outcome is an intentional outcome. It is the consequence of the interaction among intentional actions. Yeah?
So then, for an insurance game, would that be considered good? Because in an insurance game, everyone is sort of, they have an idea of what the expected outcome is, right?
Right, but in an assurance game, it is still the case that there are information conditions that have to be satisfied, and you'll have a causal explanation for why those information conditions are satisfied. The causal explanation can be that the network that binds together people within this game is such as to yield high quality information to all the actors. That's a consequence of the nature of that network. And therefore, you'd say the network is a cause of the high quality information which enables the actors to translate their own preferences into a collective outcome, which is also their preference. And that would be the right way, to describe the interface between ordinary causal explanation and intentional explanation in an assurance game. All right, that's functional versus intentional explanation. What's wrong with the superstructural view of the state? Well, I think the basic problem with the simple superstructural view of the state is the absence of adequate mechanisms that explain the functionality of the superstructure. It's simply assumed rather than elaborated. The functionality of the state or anything else, you can't just take it for granted. It's not automatic. There's no inherent reason, simply because we call this a system, that the parts all fit together in a way that constitutes the whole as a self-reproducing system. The image of the state as a superstructure tends to short-circuit an investigation of such mechanisms. So while I think it is legitimate to include these functional elements, and I certainly think it's a good working hypothesis as a starting point for analysis that the state is functional for capital and for capitalism, I think that's a kind of nice first approximation point of departure. It's a way of posing questions rather than itself being a definitive answer. I then, in my own thinking on these things, modify this functionalist image of the state in several ways. And I've listed these here. These are all themes that we'll be discussing in various ways throughout this section of the course. First, the state is an arena of struggle. It's not simply a structure that reproduces capitalism. It's a site of struggle. And this means its functionality is contested rather than automatic. The struggles that take place within the state may interfere with its capacity to fulfill its functions. So there are these functional needs for capitalism, but they can be undermined, disrupted, made complicated by virtue of the struggles which take place. This makes functionality as potentially problematic, as opposed to given. So that's the first point. Functionality is contested. The second point is that the system of which the state is a part is a very complex system, in which there are many different functional requirements for its reproduction. And the state has to be located within all of this complexity in ways in which there is no guarantee whatsoever that all of these conditions for reproducing capitalism are consistent with each other. So there may be some kind of vague bottom line, preventing revolution. But that's hardly enough to explain why the state does what it does. Most of what the state does is not in the service of preventing revolution. Most of what it does is in the service of creating social order, providing for social integration, creating the favorable conditions for accumulation. And all of these things may not be consistent with each other. What you have to do to create social harmony, which is good for capitalism, may not be the same as what you have to do to secure the conditions for profit maximizing for firms. And there's all sorts of inconsistencies and incompatibilities among these potential functional requirements. All of this becomes further complicated by this very interesting property of the state, which is something we'll be discussing, I think, two lectures hence. It's a very interesting feature of the state that in order for it to fulfill certain basic functions that are needed for capitalism, it needs a certain level of autonomy. If the state is just in the pockets of powerful capitalist actors, if they literally just pull the levers from outside, then the state is going to serve the particular interests of particular capitalists, but there's no reason whatsoever to imagine that that's good for capitalism. What we call crony capitalism, a kind of state-capital relation where the state is in the pocket of powerful capitalist interests, tends to produce a very dysfunctional state. So states need to have a certain kind of autonomy with respect to the capitalist class in order to be good for capitalism. But that autonomy also creates the possibility of the state doing things that aren't good for capitalists. And in particular, state managers, state elites, and various other kinds of interests may be embedded in these states that take advantage of this autonomy. It's what sometimes is referred to as the Frankenstein problem. That you create a state that has the necessary autonomy to effectively regulate and reproduce capitalism, but to give it that autonomy, you have to also give it powers, which you may or may not be able to subordinate to capital. The Frankenstein problem. This is all about contradictory functionality. And the third point is the state is an historically specific condensation of all of these processes. Historically specific is captured by the word contingent. Class struggles can impinge on the ability of the state to serve the ruling class in optimal ways, and state actors may have autonomy in coping with the complex contradictory functionality that the state is required to fulfill. All of these seriously challenge the idea of a smooth, coherent functionality, which you find in some traditional Marxist state theory. A full account of the state must integrate, on the one hand, this account of state functions and the mechanisms which enable the state to fulfill those functions, and on the other, the process of struggle and institution building which transforms the state and its mechanisms, and which does so in a way that may actually intensify contradictions inside of the state. And that's why I think we can think of the state as contingent, contested, contradictory functionality. So if you want a mouthful of words to capture what the theory of the state that I am laying out in various ways here, it would be that. Contingent meaning historically specific outcome of institution building and past struggles. Contested meaning that struggle is at the center of it, and contradictory meaning that the functionality of the state is never simple and smooth. It's always complex and often inconsistent. All right. That's the preface. Now we get to the dictionary. Let's go on for another 10 minutes or so, get the dictionary started. We'll launch the dictionary, and then we'll take a break. At the core of the dictionary, which I'm going to give you, is a term that I've used a little bit. I don't think we haven't yet had a full-blown discussion of what this word is all about, and it's the term practice. We'll be talking about political practices. Anybody else need a outline? Okay. Okay. Is this the copy? This is one copy, right?
Yeah. Do we need two for today? Okay. I'll get another one and bring it. Will you be in the room?
Let's see. What we're going to have to do, since I want to, at the break, we're going to pass out the papers. So no, what you should do is just give me two blank sheets of paper with your name on it, and we'll put them in the pile so people will just get them, and then they'll find you and you'll arrange to give them a copy. Okay. All right. Practice. So I'm going to give you a particular way of thinking about this term. This is not, you should not take this as authoritative. This is one of these words that gets used in all sorts of ways. Bourdieu uses the word practice in a way that's different from the way I'm going to use it. I'm using the word practice in a way that comes out of the French structuralist tradition, although I think in other respects my use is not, it doesn't fit into a structuralist theory. But it's a particular way of understanding practice that I think makes it fill a purpose within the Marxian tradition that is better than just talking about human activity or action or behavior. So basically the problem is this. We observe people doing things in the world, individually and collectively. And a lot of what we do in social science is study what people do. There's different terms that are used to capture this. So just think of the ordinary language terms and then their sociological incarnations. We can talk about behavior. People behave. And there's indeed a tradition of social science that's called behavioral sciences. That's kind of out of favor these days. You don't, in sociology, so much talk about social behavior. There's action. That's another term. People engage, people act in the world. They engage in actions. And practices is another way of talking about what people do. Now, each of these is bound up with a set of deeper conceptual understandings of the relationship between persons and their doings and the doings and the world in which they do, they act. I think all are legitimate. I don't see any reason to say, no, everything is a practice. No, some things are practices, some things are actions. It's not the right way to think about it. These are different ways of characterizing the activities of people. Let me just very briefly draw the distinctions and then focus on practice. So behavior is identified with behaviorism, that's a kind of tradition in psychology, where essentially activities of people are viewed as conditioned, as not being the result of choice and deliberation, as essentially being the result of behavioral conditioning of one sort or another. The term behavior essentially amalgamates human activity to animal activity. So we talk about animal behavior, and we don't talk about the practices of a horse, right? You don't even really talk about the actions of a horse. It's the behavior of a horse. Behavioral modification. Now, when you talk about a child and you're trying to discipline them into being a good kid or an obedient kid, you talk about behavioral modification, right? What you're trying to do is just create reinforcers and sanctions to change their behavior. And you're not so much trying to make them more deliberate, meaningful participants. You know, what the expression behavioral modification is really treating a person in the same way you would train a dog. You, with dog, you have reinforcers, you have treats that you give them whenever they do the right thing, and the gold stars that you put on the, you know, the toddler's door or the first grader's door to show that they've had a good day when they need this. That's behavioral modification. That's behavior. That's the least rich view of human agency, very thin view of agency, in which the distinction between human and non-human action becomes pretty thin. Action as a way of talking about what people do in the sociology tradition is generally associated with perspectives that say the key thing we need to understand about human activity is the meanings people have. So what are called theories of action are typically approaches to understanding behavior in which you try to figure out the meanings that the actors bring to their activity. Action is meaningful to the actor. It's subjectively meaningful, coherent with respect to their worldviews and their identities. The Weberian tradition of sociology places a lot of emphasis on meaning of action as a way of explaining activity, what people do. And the term action, not always, but generally, is associated with views of human activity that emphasize the action-meaning nexus. Yeah.
To assume some level of rationality then?
That's an additional element to the extent to which the activities are calculative and have a means-end structure. It's not always, doesn't always imply that. It can. That's an additional issue. It's just that it's the meaning content of the action that is at the heart of it. In most sociological work that uses the expression action, and particularly what's called theories of action, are preoccupied with the meaningfulness of what people do. Behavior treats human doings largely as if they were habits. Action treats human activity as motivated, but as motivated through the meanings of actors. Now, practices are a different angle, a different way of thinking about human activity. It focuses on what the activity does in the world, what its effects in the world are. Of course, that brings with it a set of habits and a set of meanings. But the primary focus on analyzing the activity is in terms of how it's connected to the world and what its consequences are. And in particular, I think the way I like to think of it is that practice is a way of talking about activity in which the core problem is the problem of how our activities transform the world in everyday life as well as in big historic events. The paradigm of a practice is economic practice. But we can use this term practice to describe economic practice, political practice, ideological practice. These are the three that I'll be mainly focusing on. But we can have a much bigger list. You can have you can talk about cultural practices, ideological practices. You can even talk about theoretical practices or scientific practices. In each case, you're talking about how a particular set of human activities has transformative effects of one sort or another. And the paradigm for economic practices would be this. Well, let me first give you the more abstract. All practices of whatever sort, if you're using this way of talking about activity, there's some kind of raw material, there's some means of transformation. Practices always deploy a means of transformation. In the case of economic practices, we call these means of production. There's always a process of transformation, and there's always a product of transformation. So, in economic practice, simple case, the raw materials are nature. The means of production are, the means of transformation are the means of production, the forces of production. The process of production is the labor process. And the product of transformation is use values. So, if you want to define an economic practice, what you would say is economic practices are human activities in which people take means of production, take nature as a raw material, and transform it through a labor process into use values, things that are useful for people. That's what an economic practice does. That can be organized in all sorts of ways. We've discussed some of them. So for each type of practice, then, you want to identify it with what it's doing in the world. And the simplest identification is what the product is. So the product of economic practices are use values, things which satisfy human needs. So we think of economic practices as producing goods and services. Well, goods and services is a little couplet to capture pretty much the broad range of use values. The things that are useful for people are goods and services which get produced through economic practices. So one way of kind of keeping track of what practices are is to think of what they do. What do they produce. Economic practices produce use values. Political practices produce social relations. Ideological practices produce subjectivities. What's the product of ideological practices? It's cognitive structures, beliefs, subjectivities. We'll get a more refined view of this later, but for the moment. But they also have raw materials, right? So what's the raw material of economic practice? It's nature. What's the raw material of ideological practice? Well, I like to think of the raw material of ideological practice is lived experience. We experience things in the world. What ideological practices do is give us interpretations. It transforms the things that happen to us, that we experience, into beliefs and ideas. There's a transformation process. Takes means of production. The means of production are ideological systems, educational systems, the media. There's all sorts of means by which our experiences get transformed into beliefs which we hold. That is, the product of ideology are beliefs that are actually subjectively salient and in the heads of people, that they actually hold these beliefs. In the case of political practices, I would argue that political practices transform social interactions between people into social relations. They transform interactions into relations. They're basically producing stable, sustained relations. This is why the feminist expression, the personal is political, makes sense. The expression, the personal is political, is a claim about the processes within intimate relations within which social relations between bodies are created. These deep interpersonal intimate relations that are built around gender get built through a set of practices. Well, there are political practices in the family, in social, with respect to children, in schools, in workplaces, all of which produce a set of social relations at the interpersonal level between biological men and biological women and turn them into gender relations. The process of production of gender relations as forms of structured relations between people would be the political practices of gender. The practices which produce the ideas in people's heads about those relations, that is, the beliefs they hold about gender, would be the ideological practices of gender. Ideological and political practices are deeply interconnected, of course. You know, if you have a deep contradiction between the ideological and political practices, you get instabilities. One of the arguments, of course, that all radicals hold in their propaganda work is the belief that if you can change the ideas of people, that can be a lever for then changing the relations. You don't have to change the relations first and the ideas follow. You can change ideas and then motivate people to change relations. So these are separable. The processes by which the relations are produced and enforced and reproduced is not the same as the process by which the ideas about those relations are produced and reinforced and reproduced, but they're connected. The reproduction of relations is a form of production of those relations. So, you know, this is this may seem like just diddling about with words, you know, trying to massage the words so it all fits neatly. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I think of transformation of reproduction of relations as one way of thinking about it is you're transforming a relation into itself. That is, relations don't just persist by inertia. They always require social work. And if you have an established set of relations, which then build the interactions between people. Remember, relations are relations among the actions, the activities of people. That's what the relata of relations are. Remember, we had that very esoteric, obscure discussion. The relata of relations. The relata of social relations are the actions of people, and since they're connecting the actions of people with each other, they are interactions. Political practices produce and transform interactions among people into social relations. Well, once you have an ongoing system, What that really means is that a lot of political practices are transforming a set of already existing, or as some Marxists have liked to say, already always present relations into themselves. Reproduction is a form of transformation. It's transforming something into itself. The presumption there is that in the absence of those political practices to reproduce those relations, they wouldn't stay the same. That is, the political practices are indeed transforming the relations into themselves by virtue of the way they block their transformation into something else. Let's finish up point one. So we've got an inventory, right? The beginnings of an inventory. We have practice as a general idea of looking at human activities in terms of its effects in the world, thinking of effects in the world with this term transformation, what you're producing with your activity. In this classroom, we're constantly producing things and transforming things. You hopefully end a class different from when you began, unless you were asleep the whole time. So what's happening here? We're engaged in practices in which ideas are being produced in your subjectivities. It's this extraordinary thing that happens through human communication. I'm talking, you're listening, and I am transforming my own ideas in the course of talking about them with you, because new formulations and tweaks come up. And your ideas, as you both listen to what I say and then introspect and chew it over, are transformed in the process. So at one level, what we're doing in this classroom is what would be called an ideological practice. Engaged in a process by which subjectivity is being produced. We're also reproducing a set of social relationships in the class. I'm the professor, you're the student, you're listening to me, I'm standing in here, you're all extremely good at this, you've been at this for many years, you know how to properly act in this interactional space so that these relations are not disruptive. You're all comfortable in this role. I'm comfortable in the role. By enacting this role and doing it in the way we do, against a background where there are sanctions for deviation from these relations. You know, so if any of you started jumping up on the table and acting, you know, completely inappropriately for a class, or standing up and denouncing me, you know, and throwing a tantrum. I mean, if any of these way off the bounds of what's acceptable in a classroom occurred, that would trigger a set of interventions which would restore the social relations in the classroom. And that's why the work that's going on here is also political practice. It's reproducing a set of relations. Now, in this case, because of the way I hope I'm teaching and the way you are participating, the relations are much less hierarchical than in some classrooms. You know, it has its own particular character. But nevertheless, we're reproducing a set of social relations. So we've got economic, political, ideological, and a whole bunch of others. We can even talk about religious practices as a distinct, or spiritual practices. I think there's a way of talking about what the product is and what the raw material is for spiritual practices. There's also an issue that we're going to be grappling with, which is the distinction between a type of practice and an aspect of practice. Now, this is getting to the kind of boundaries of the conceptual space in social science, where things can get very confused and people talk past each other all the time as to what they're talking about. Here's how I want to make this distinction. And I'll do this with respect to political practice. We can distinguish the political aspects of social practices in general from political practice as a type of practice. Now, when it's a type of practice, I like to use the word politics. Politics is the term we use to describe political practices when it's the political type of practice that we're talking about. To speak of the political aspects of any social practice is to discuss the way in which that practice produces and transforms relations. So a foreman in a factory supervising workers and seeing that they are doing their proper work in a labor process is engaged in an economic practice, that is, that's part of the process of production, is to see that the actors in the different parts of the labor process are doing what they're supposed to be doing. But it's also, there's a political aspect to that economic practice, because the foreman, in walking around and giving instructions, is also reproducing the social relations of hierarchy and authority within the labor process. The foreman is producing a set of social relations, but that is not the purpose of the practice. It's an economic practice because its purpose is to coordinate the activities of the workers. But its byproduct is, or an aspect of it, is to reproduce the social relations. To speak of political practice as a type of practice implies that the intention of the actors, the intention is to produce transformations of relations. Actors are conscious subjects and may take social relations as their intentional object. So when we talk about politics in the mundane sense, Scott Walker pushing through some legislation, people going to the state capitol to oppose that legislation, what's in play there is the nature of the social relations that govern the activities of state workers and the access to jobs and all sorts of other things. Those are all about social relations. That's what's in play. The state is a centralized and crucial institution for this because of its capacity to impose binding rules on people. But binding rules simply means enforcement of social relations. That's what a binding rule is. The state has a unique and special capacity to it, but universities do as well. Universities impose rules on students all the time. And when students protest them, what they're engaged in, the politics of the academy. They're engaged in a struggle over what the rule should be to which they are subjected. That's a political struggle, but it's a political type of struggle. And we can call that perfectly legitimately academic politics. Academic politics are when you're struggling around what the rules of the game should be within the academy. So the type of, in my view, the type of practice refers to the purposes of the actors. The aspects of practice refer simply to what the effects of the practice are. There are political aspects of all practices, but not all practices are political practices. That is, not all practices are politics. Some are and some aren't. There's also, of course, multiplicity of types of political practice itself. We can talk about gender politics, producing and reproducing gender relations. Academic politics produces and reproduces the rules of the game in the university. That is, the nature of the social relations that bind together students and faculty and staff and other people. Class politics reproduces and produces class relations. So there are many different types of practice, political practice. Politics is not just a question of the public sphere in the use that I'm giving. Some people indeed want to say that the term politics should be restricted to the public sphere, that the public-private distinction also corresponds to the political-non-political distinction. That's, you know, you can use words however you want. That's one, there is a coherent way of describing, restricting politics that way. People who restrict politics that way basically are restricting it to the state. It becomes a very state-centered view of the political. Whereas I think the political is a dimension of all social relations, and political practices can be thought of within the family as much as within the private sphere, the public sphere. The definition of politics that I've given, therefore, is broader than in many Marxist analyses. In Marxist analysis, politics is often very state-centered. And although contemporary Marxists, of course, have been affected by feminists and so on, and so the notion that there are that the personal can be political is also something that many Marxists would agree with, but that is not a conventional and traditional way that Marxists have thought about politics. All right, so that's the first component, this notion of practice. Now, if practices in general, and political practices then as a type of practice, involve a raw material and a means of production to produce an outcome, the means of production in the case of economic practices are pretty clear. Means of production of economic practices are the means of production, forces of production. We know that forces of production develop in history. Some forces of production are much more productive. We can talk about the productivity of a force of production. One way of thinking about it is that forces of production can be more or less powerful. That is, the means of production are the powers we have to transform nature into a use value. And those powers can be very feeble when all you've got is your hands and a few hand tools, or they can be very powerful if you have complicated machinery and sources of energy. The same is true for politics. There's a means of production in politics. And what's in play there is the nature of power, which will be the topic we'll begin with after the break. So it is 11:21. Let's reconvene at 11:30. And here, everybody, give me your two copies of the paper for the piles.
That's an extra one.
All right. All right, now here's a concept for you. Talk about concepts that are heavily battled over in social theory. The concept of power. Power. That's one of your all-time contested concepts. Let me, and I'm not going to review all of the ins and outs of different concepts of power. I'm sure if we did an inventory of different theoretical stances on this term, we'd probably have several dozen different ways in which the notion of power can be defined.
So, Eric, just to clarify, you said power is the means of production.
It's an attribute of the means of production.
Of the
right. But I'm going to first discuss power in general and then get us specifically to political power. Okay? So first, power in general. All practices of whatever sort involve power, that is, capacity to produce the transformations specific to the practice. This is a absolutely simple, almost everyday language notion of power. If you're powerful if you can accomplish a lot of things. Just think of it in terms of strength. You know, you're a powerful person if you can lift a lot of stuff. You can lift heavy weights. That makes you physically powerful. This power is a way of talking about your capacities to do things. You have a powerful mind if you have a capacity to think deep and complicated thoughts or whatever. Power is a capacity to do things, to accomplish things. And in the context of practices then, practices transform things to produce products. Power is a way of talking about your capacity to accomplish those transformations. Economic power refers to your capacity to transform nature. Political power to your capacity to transform social relations. Ideological power to your capacity to transform subjectivity. Someone or some agent or some institution is ideologically powerful if it has enormous capacity to forge beliefs and get them instilled in people. Now, ideological power is not the capacity to propagandize, it's the capacity to have your propaganda believed. That is, you're ideologically powerful if you can send out messages and it'll affect the minds and subjectivities of people. It's often, therefore, not so easy, in the case of ideology, to know if a particular institution is or is not ideologically powerful. There's often a lot of illusion and self-deception going on here. It looked like the Soviet Union, that machinery of ideological domination was super powerful, and then suddenly we realized the emperor had no clothes. That is, nobody believed the stuff by the time the Soviet Union fell. Everybody was cynical about it. You know, 90% of the Soviet citizens thought it was complete bullshit what they heard on the radio. So that means it was ideologically weak, not strong. even though it had complete domination over the production of ideas and the dissemination. That didn't mean it was ideologically powerful. It was economically powerful because it could block anybody else getting access to the means of transformation of that particular in that particular service. The media was politically powerful, although that also masked a lot of weakness. Its capacity to reproduce social relations was eroding, even though for a long time it was able to block opposition. So ideological power is the power to actually instill beliefs in people. In the Weberian tradition, that's why charisma is this really interesting idea. Charismatic authority, charismatic people, are fantastically successful purveyors of ideology. They are able to deeply affect the subjectivities of others. The beginning of new religious movements, which profoundly shape the ideas and beliefs of people, are often led by charismatic people who have this enormous capacity to affect other people's minds, other people's subjectivity. That's what ideological power is. Political power, you're really powerful politically if you have a capacity to produce and transform relations. So that's the notion of power as a capacity to do things. It does not inherently mean power over others. Now, it may in some contexts, but the question of what the distribution of power is and how much power is to be distributed are not identical questions. You can have a consensual-based democratic group which has enormous capacity to build its social relations. So it has a lot of power with respect to a certain domain, even though it's reciprocal, democratic, and egalitarian. So how much power is in a system, that is what it can do, what its capacities are, and how it's distributed, I think, need to be separated. In many cases that we care about, of course, power does depend upon power over. It is relational. I'm not saying that it's not relational, but it often doesn't imply, it's not the case that one would say, I have no power because I can't force you to do something, because we may together have an enormous amount of power to coordinate our activities and to forge collective projects. That's power in general, first step. Second step, a distinction between what we can call instrumental and structural power. This is getting even more difficult and complicated. The instrumental meaning of power, I think, is the simplest. To say that a particular individual group has a great deal of political power instrumentally is to say that they control a variety of resources which enables them to effectively transform relations. These resources constitute the means of production of political practice, and the conscious use of those means of production of political practice accomplish transformations is what we call politics. And instrumentally, what we mean is there are people who consciously use those instruments to accomplish the reproduction and transformation of relations. That's the instrumental meaning of political power. But there's also a sense in which a group can be structurally powerful politically, even if the individuals don't consciously wield instruments of political power. And this is what gets much harder, much more elusive as a way of talking about power. We can say that a group is structurally powerful politically, even though they don't instrumentally wield power for political purposes. What does that mean, to say they're structurally powerful? Well, here's how I would say it. A group is structurally powerful when the unintended political aspects of social practices reproduce or transform relations in ways which serve the interests of that group. That is, a group is structurally powerful when the unintended political aspects of their social practices, not the purposes of their social practices, but the byproducts, the side effects of their social practices, the unintended aspects of their social practices, produce social relations that serve their interests. Thus, for example, in the current financial crisis, let's take the Greek example, or the Italian example for that matter, bond prices go up to an unacceptable level that risks the complete collapse of the Italian state and the Italian economy and the destruction of the euro. All of that is in play. Now, it's mostly in play because that is a byproduct of investors simply making their own individual choices about what they're willing to pay for a loan from the Italian government given the uncertainties of the future. That is, this is not a case of a group of bondholders getting together in a dark room and saying, aha, how can we bring down the Italian government? If it was that, then they would be engaged in instrumental power. That is, they would be using their control over resources for the purpose of producing a change in Italian politics. But that's not really how it happens. I mean, I think that's a minor part of this drama. Mostly, these enormously powerful actors in the world economy, the big financial investors and the financial instruments which they control, they're just pursuing profit-maximizing strategies to make as much money as they can through their choices. They see risks and they want to avoid risks, or they'll only engage them for very high premiums. And that turns out to have enormously powerful effects on the possibilities of transforming and producing social relations. And it does so in a way that serves their interests. That is, their interests get satisfied in the austerity program, not the interests of the average Italian person. It's the interests of bankers and financiers that get taken care of in this kind of crisis condition. Now, that's because they are indeed powerful, but not instrumentally powerful. They're structurally powerful. That is, they don't have to wield this for that purpose. The systematic character of the byproducts of their actions are what serves their interests. That's what structural power means. To say a group is structurally powerful doesn't mean that by virtue of their position in a structure they are instrumentally powerful. That's just being instrumentally powerful. Of course you're instrumentally powerful by virtue of your position in a social structure. It's not by virtue of anything else. I mean, you're structurally powerful politically because you're in a structurally powerful, I mean, you're instrumentally powerful in a system because you're in a social position that gives you access to the levers of power. It may be that structurally powerful actors are also instrumentally powerful. The titans of industry may be able to knock on the door of the prime minister or the president or the central bank and say, damn it, you do what I tell you. That means that they're using their structural position to directly threaten the state or these actors. That's being instrumentally powerful. It may be by virtue of their structural power, but the structural power itself is simply the effects of their ordinary actions on maintaining the system in a way that's congruent with their interests. That's how I would, in any case, talk about structural power. Structural, in contrast to instrumental power. It's a mistake, I think, to mainly see the way this financial crisis has played out in terms of the personal networks and connections. You know, a lot has been made about Geithner being Obama's henchman. You know, I'm not saying that's not relevant. It helps to explain a variety of things. But the main reason why the American government bailed out the banks was because of the consequences for every interest and the functioning of the system if there was a complete collapse, and the feeling that the alternative strategies would have been politically impossible to accomplish. Nationalize the bank, dispossess the financiers. And given that that's ruled out, and that might have been ruled out partially for instrumental reasons, you would have had an insurrection of bankers, perhaps, but for whatever reasons that was ruled out, the main source of power that was shaping the state's policies was this structural power that was just embedded in the operation of the system. That's the structural versus instrumental power. The next element of the dictionary, the means and the efficacy of instruments of power. So in analyzing any type of power, whether economic, ideological, or political, it's important to establish both what constitutes the main means of transformation. What are the means of transformation in politics, in ideology, in the economy? And to determine how efficacious are they? What's the efficacy of these means of production? This is very familiar in the case of economics, right? In economic practices and in the discussion of economic power, I think this is very familiar. Economic power is the capacity to produce transformations of nature. That's what it is. The forces of production are the means of production deployed in such practices, and the efficacy of those forces of production is defined by their technical productivity. The economic power of an individual or class, if we want to say this class is very powerful economically, it depends both upon the extent to which they monopolize the means of production and how powerful are the means of production which they monopolize. So a titan of industry in industrial capitalism is much more powerful economically than a feudal lord was. Right, so they're much more powerful economically. They have more economic power because the means of production which they monopolize, which they have control over, are much more powerful means of production than in the case of feudalism. That's why the power of feudal lords depended much more on their direct control over political power. Feudal lords extracted surplus from feudal peasants because they had knights that went out and took it. You know, it was a directly coercive system of extraction because their economic power, even if they had a lot of economic power with respect to their property rights over the land, was nowhere near enough to give them the surplus they needed for purposes of knightly depredations and reproducing the class structure. So we want to talk both about the extent to which the means of production of politics are monopolized by particular groups, how egalitarian or inegalitarian is the distribution of access to those means of politics, and how efficacious are they, how powerful are the means of politics. Both are relevant parts of our discussion. If you have a democratic distribution of power, but the state is extremely weak and can't do anything, right, that's a much less empowering form of distribution of power than if you have a democratic distribution of power and a very effective state with lots of capacities to do things. One of the arguments I make in envisioning real utopias, and even more, I think this is made in the discussion of democracy in the book American Society, How It Really Works, one of the arguments I make is that in assessing the extent to which the United States is or is not democratic, there's both the question of how powerful is the democracy, that is, how many important collective decisions is it even capable of making, and the question of how equal is the access of ordinary people to participate in such decisions. A system is less democratic if very few decisions can be made that affect the social relations in the society. If you have a very narrow definition of the public sphere and the private sphere and the role of the state, then even if power within that state is evenly distributed, it's a less democratic system because less of the collective decisions that affect people's lives is under the purview of democracy. Well, that has to do with the power of this, the efficacy of the democratic system, as well as the distribution of access to the means of making those decisions. What then are the means of politics? What's the means of production within politics? I think the way to think of it is that organizations of different sorts are the crucial means of politics. The key means of politics are political parties and the state. Those are the two main organizations that we think of, but lots of social movements, trade unions, even various kinds of clubs, associations. All of these are the means of politics. That is, all of these are what give people the capacity to engage in the process of producing and transforming social relations. Organizations are central to political power because of their role in mobilizing collective action and constraining choice. Organizations are the central means of political practice. But really, of course, any resource that bears on the capacity to transform relations can be considered a pertinent means of politics. Yeah?
Can you repeat this point that you made right before?
Organizations are central to political power because of their role in mobilizing collective action and constraining choice. So, for example, but anything can really be a means of politics. Economic resources can be political resources and enhance political power. The translation of economic resources into political power can be done through very crude mechanisms. You know, corruption is a use of economic resources for political purposes. So it's deploying economic resources as a means of politics if you buy your way into office. But it can be used as in very subtle ways, as in the structural power that's embedded in the way that private investments shape political agendas discussed by politicians. So those are all facts in which economic resources are means of politics. But political power is also affected by the efficacy of means of organizational means. There's a very interesting discussion around political parties in which, particularly around historically, around Lenin's innovations. In What Is to Be Done, Lenin proposes a particular design of political parties. And one way of thinking about it is he's saying, look, we're weak, we're a minority, we're facing huge odds. How can we organize our political action, our collective capacities, in a way to give us maximum power with the same material resources? We don't have a lot of resources. What kind of party would accomplish that? And his vision of a kind of democratic centralist party, which he laid out in at least a sketch, was a idea to create what some people called an organizational weapon. It was a way of making an organization greater, that had greater capacity for coordinating, for mobilizing. He may have been right or wrong in that assessment. That particular party structure may have had unintended consequences, which made it very powerful for some purposes and not for others. It may have turned out to be a very bad instrument for building an egalitarian alternative and a good instrument for destroying the existing system. But nevertheless, that was a discussion about how to organize the means of political practice in a way that would increase their efficacy. In the labor movement, there's a lot of discussion about what form of labor organization enhances its capacity for struggle and what forms ultimately are self-limiting, which may be very good for certain kinds of struggle, but really quickly reach limits of possibility and become less efficacious. This was the big fight in the 1930s between the CIO and the AFL. The AFL organized workers on the basis of narrowly defined trades. The CIO organized workers on the basis of sectors or workplaces as a whole. And there's clear arguments on both sides. If you're in a skilled trade and you've got capacity to exclude workers from access to those jobs because of credentials and expertise, then organizing on a trade basis may enhance your capacity to protect your jobs and enhance the wages of the members of that particular sector. But it, of course, undermines the capacity for broader solidarities that enable you to challenge the power of capital, let alone use your collective power to intervene in politics. The CIO had a vision, and the Wobblies even more, but the CIO became, I think, the historically relevant one, in the 30s certainly, of having one big union. I mean, the expression one big union was the IWW's expression, but the CIO is in that spirit, that a more encompassing organization would have greater capacity to fight the biggest centers of power. Not necessarily to accomplish the most for individual segments of workers in particular settings, but overall to create the broadest solidarity and also to intervene politically. It's why the Communist Party was much more engaged with the CIO, as it were, than with the AFL, because it shared this vision of needing concentrated, coordinated organization as a vehicle for political power. Well, those are all about the means of production of politics. And again, this is the way you think about it, or a way to think about it when you're analyzing actions in terms of practices. I guess we, this means we fall behind once again. So, it's not to be avoided, I think. I will begin with domination and get to the state. We'll do that at the beginning of the next lecture, and then on Monday, and then turn to the Terborn and Offey pieces.